sectarian violence is increasing?
Well, I think there are certainly groups that are increasingly trying to widen fissures between ethnic and religious groups. I think we see that in Nigeria. I think we certainly see that in Kenya. Al-Shabaab is trying to exploit latent tensions between communities in Kenya. And I think that the way the government has responded so far is not countering this effort. In some ways, Al-Shabaab is exploiting these differences. And instead of
Lezalefko, we're going to have to leave it there. But I thank you very much for being with us. Deputy Director of Human Rights Watch's Africa Division. We'll link to your report on the in 2014 that looked at killings and disappearances by anti-terror police in Kenya. That does it for our broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our website's democracynow.org. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to WHFR Dearborn. And now it's time for our public affairs show, and we call it the new WHFR Journal. Hello and welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal. Why is it new? It's not the same as last week. So you got to tune in every week or go to our website, whfr.fm, and listen to the podcast anytime. It's available anytime immediately after broadcast. Just click on the talk show button in the middle of the homepage and then choose WHFR Journal and select the date. And today is April the 3rd, 2015. Good Friday, as it's known by most people in the United States. In a way, if you look at the historic details of it, what was good about it? It's interesting that in many other countries around the world, did a little bit of research here, as I like to do with holidays, because very often we forget what the original idea of the holiday was, and therefore we miss out on the original spirit. And you say, well, it's just a Christian holiday. I'm not Christian, and you know, let those Christians, but I think religious holidays do have meaning to all of us if we understand what they're celebrating. And of course, we want to make sure that we're getting it right, I think, staying close to the original intent, which usually had a pretty good purpose. So around the world, this Good Friday, as we call it, is sometimes referred to as Black Friday. I'm wearing all black today. No, it's not television, so I had to mention that to you. And let's see, in Germany, I can get to Germany here. They even have a feeling that the term is even a little bit more ugly. It's Mourning Friday. Mourning, M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G, Mourning Friday, because it's referred to as Karfreitag. Karfreitag from old, Kar comes from old High German, Kara, bewail, grief, mourn, and Freitag, of course, is the German word for Friday. So it's Mourning Friday. The day is also sometimes known as Stiller Freitag, which means Silent Friday. It's a time for quiet contemplation about the events. And the events, of course, for those that may not remember, had to do with the crucifixion of Jesus. And the year, the estimated year, is approximately AD 33 by two different groups. And originally, Isaac Newton said it was AD 34, but close enough. So, and AD stands for after the death of Jesus Christ. So, you know, there depends how you calculate it. Obviously, he can't have been crucified 33 years after he died. So because crucifixion ends in death, so that does seem a little bit strange. But that's where it is. Just differences in our calendars and other discussions. But nonetheless, it was to mark this crucifixion act, which was a punishment that was given to Jesus for relatively minor indiscretions. It's interesting that the Bible, in several different accounts, and we're talking about the canonical Gospels of Mark, Matthew, Luke, and John, who, interestingly, if you read some books from people who are religious scholars and have actually studied those texts in detail, there's a lot of contradictions and exclusions between Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. So who had it right? Well, often when people are rewriting about the death of Jesus, like, you know, current popular book is Killing Jesus. Bill O'Reilly wrote that. And obviously he took a little bit of each one, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and folded it into a dramatic, good dramatic story. Otherwise, the book wouldn't be as popular. I've not read it, though. But I'm just saying is that Matthew, Mark, John, and Luke didn't get it consistent, either the birth or the death of Jesus. And there's other problems, too, with those four Gospels. So it's like, who are they getting the word from? We do know that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, none of them were written in the time of Christ. That however they were composed, and even if Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John were historical figures that lived at the time of Christ, it was hundreds of years later, well, at least 60 to 100 anyway, minimum, depending on the scholar you read, when they were actually written down. So who knows who got it right in terms of the story. But it's interesting, if you look at Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John in the Bible, they kind of exonerate the Roman Empire. Pontius Pilate was the Roman leader in the Middle East at that time. And his wife said, oh, don't do anything to Jesus. He's a holy man, you know. And he literally washed his hands of the affairs a couple times rather than punish Jesus other than some flogging. Just he thought, well, that was appropriate considering what he's done and just a little flogging. But then and then he gave Jesus back to King Herod, who was the leader of the land, the king of the land. And Herod, really sort of passed the buck, too. So it looks like that the leaders, these dictators, were kind of absolved by Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John of any responsibility for this, because the people that actually said, crucify him, were the mobs of the Middle East at that time, that for whatever reason, either they didn't like him saying he was king of the Jews, which would, of course, could be conceived as blasphemous, because only God in the heavens, inside the dogma, of course, would be the king of the Jews, and everybody else who was a believer anyway. So the story has a lot of loopholes there. There's a lot of wonderful dramatizations, but they never get it right, and neither does Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and so who knows exactly. It looks like historical Jesus did exist, and he was punished by being nailed to a cross and died. And anything else, you have to, pick who or what you believe and carry it through. That whole time of his capture by the Romans and his so-called trials and his having to walk through the streets with a cross as he was going to Calvary, the hill on which all the crucified people had their crosses placed, and then they were nailed to the cross, and the cross was raised until they died a while later. So supposedly the day of historical Jesus' crucifixion is what's being thought about today. And it is sad, which is, I think, the term Black Friday or Silent Friday or Mourning Friday is much more accurate, because the term good here has a reference to the ancient use of the term good. Not good as a wonderful thing, but good as just sort of a holy or respectful time. But that was a long time ago that the word had that meaning. So I think I'm all in favor of changing the title of the holiday for the various different religions that do respect it. And, of course, they're all Christian religions of one sort or the other. Let's see what else we know here. In the Roman Catholic Church, it's clearly a day of fasting. And the Latin Church is understood as having only, which what they mean by fasting is not to eat, but having only one full meal, but smaller than a regular meal in the day. But they could also have two collations. It is a smaller repast, two of which together do not equal one full meal. A couple of snacks. So smaller than a regular meal and a couple of snacks. And it's also a day on which the faithful abstain from eating meat. And for some reason, the traditions don't say anything about fish. But fish have meat? Yes. I mean, fish meat. That's how I talk about it. So we're talking about meat from domesticated, or not domesticated, but from animals that live on the land, I guess. Cows, chickens, pigs, and so on. So you can't eat that kind of meat. But actually, as vegetarians and vegans know, fish are meat. Fish is meat. Okay? And saying I'm not going to eat my hamburger, but I'm going to eat fish instead, doesn't work. Macaroni and cheese would work unless you're, of course, a vegan and the cheese is not something you want to eat because it's been gotten from animals. So there you go. So anyway, those who are remembering that day, it was a terrible event to happen, someone being tortured brutally to death for no really very good reason, except maybe the madness of the crowd, of the crowds in the area. I would put some blame certainly on the leaders, Pontius Pilate and Herod. Now, Pilate actually felt he let this happen, even though he could have stopped it. He felt because the crowd was so unruly and wild that he was afraid of a riot, a civil riot. So he thought he was doing a public service by preventing the civil riot and letting Jesus be the one to be crucified. Remember that, like when Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John wrote their, or had their so-called Gospels written down, whether or not they did it or other people, maybe based on some written records or hearsay or whatever it was, the Roman Empire was still doing pretty well. And was in a lot of control. And in fact, the Christian church was not allowed to have above ground official practice of Christianity. It was still an outlawed religion by about 200 AD. Now, yes, there was accommodations made later for the Eastern church and for the Western Catholic church. But it was tough. It was a tough time. And so in a way, whoever wrote, however inspired Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John were, you don't want to write something down that makes the governing powers hate you and want to come and hunt you down in your underground catacombs or wherever you're meeting privately for your services. So I think they might have whitewashed the story a little bit for their own continuation, even though underground at that time. So that was the meaning, and it is a somber moment whenever anyone dies, and for no good reason, and also someone who was a great teacher of a lot of principles. Whether or not you believe in Christianity and the dogma of the Christian churches, the historical Jesus, he's historic and he's historical, did exist, and his teachings are things that a lot of people can believe in. Even today, they're extremely relevant, and so, you know, he should be studied and understood. Of course, there's still a little bit of difference as to what he actually said, because he apparently didn't write anything down. So you have to look for documents of the time, of one source or another, and make comparisons and try to figure out what was going on there. But there you go. It is not an official holiday in the United States, and it's not official holiday in Michigan. but state holiday it is in Connecticut, Delaware, Florida, Hawaii, Indiana, Kentucky, Louisiana, New Jersey, North Carolina, North Dakota, Tennessee, and Texas. It's also a holiday in the U.S. territories of Guam, the U.S. Virgin Islands, and Puerto Rico. And, of course, the always ethical and honest financial market and stock markets are closed on Good Friday also, in respect for the nature of the day. And didn't Jesus have that line about the moneylenders should get out of the temple? However, of course, more retail stores remain open today. It's interesting that Fairlane Town Center is not open today here in Dearborn. I didn't realize that they closed in the past on, or is it Easter? No, they're open today, but not Easter. Easter is going to be closed. Yeah, right. So most stores are open today. Some stores in when I was growing up in the 1950s were closed from 12 to 3 because Christians did go to the sort of Stations of the Cross observances, which was largely just meditational. It wasn't an actual mass, but it was a service, and the priest would go to each supposed Station of the Cross in different places in the church and say the appropriate words of to memorialize and to understand those moments. Anyway, let's see. But you can get mail, so you can be sure to check your mailbox today. State and local government offices and courts are closed, like here in Dearborn. City government closed down. Nectar Court is closed down. And some banks and post offices in the states that say it's a holiday, but not here in Michigan. I don't believe the post offices are down today. I could be wrong in that, but anyway. So there you go. A lot of things going on. This is the new WHFR Journal from WHFR.fm. We're making waves, doing things a little bit differently than other stations. My name is Jay Koronek, if I didn't say that before today. I'm station advisor here at WHFR and 30 years strong, and we're just getting started. Our pledge drive, by the way, is coming up. Our once-a-year, on-the-air pledge drive starts a week from Sunday. That's April 12th. And so if you tune in between April 12th and Saturday, April 18th, you will hear the DJs asking you to make a pledge to us to help support our unique mission, non-commercial, independent media, both broadcast FM and the internet stream that we have in our podcast. That is unlike any other station in the world, especially because we focus on so much local music from people either living in Michigan, born in Michigan, or using Michigan music companies to distribute their work. But we play a wide variety of formats and genres too, and most other stations, certainly in this area, in Detroit area, do not have that same sort of format. We call it alternative variety. We hope you can support us because, with the exception of yours truly and just two others, everyone else is a volunteer. They don't have to be here, okay? They're here because they believe in our mission and how it can it's a value to you, if and tell your friends too, because it can make a difference. Just like local news, this show is the new WHFR Journal, and it is about Dearborn and the surrounding area, and that's it pretty much. Now, there are a few topics like the environment and so on that affect everybody in the world, so we will sometimes jump into those topics. There are some topics that affect everyone in the state of Michigan, so sometimes we'll cover those. But so our pledge drive does not start until the phone is already ringing. That's wonderful, but I can't answer it right now because I'm talking on the air, and we won't take over the air pledges until Sunday, April 12th, okay? Just so you know. Let's look at some of the stories from Dearborn Press and Guide and the Dearborn Heights situation, too. Just reaching to grab the old newspaper, Press and Guide and Times Herald, even though they don't currently have any full-time reporters. They got a couple part-timers, and first couple pages have a couple stories, usually just press releases from the city, which if you're signed up at cityofdearborn.org, you already got the stuff sent to you electronically. But nonetheless, let's take a look at this from last Sunday. And I didn't see this story anywhere else because City of Dearborn, they don't care, I guess, about the historical museum. They cut the budget pretty much. But the story is pretty good. News is that there's an endowment being started for the historical museum. And they found $53,000 that is seed money and to keep the Museum Guild. It's called the Museum Guild of Dearborn. That's consisting of 20 various organizations and about 400 total members. They started the fund last May. And they say, we've always had these small fundraisers, but they don't raise a lot of money. That's according to Rick Danes, who's president of the group. He says, we've been talking about how we can better fund the museum, and we're looking for something that had a little bit of longevity. We wanted to start an endowment, hoping it would grow. We get no budget from the city. They cut that out over 3 years ago, which I think is a terrible shame and crime, and something that every taxpayer of Dearborn would want to donate a small portion of the city budget to. It's just wrong. Anyway, Jack Cade is curator of the museum, Tate, and the budget has run for the museum between $300,000 and $360,000 annually over the past few years. That includes salaries and maintenance expenses for events and so on. So, just so you know, that takes a little bit of money. And, of course, Jack Tate's salary appropriately should be somewhere between $60,000 and $100,000. I'm not sure what it is, but he's kind of part-time. But he's doing a great job with no money from the city. And so they're starting the endowment. Obviously, the money, the endowment could be spent just as cash, but they're hoping to, I guess, invest it somewhere so they can get a couple percentage of interest back. And if they get enough money in the endowment, they could live on the interest. But that would be a couple millions of dollars before they could live on $300,000 a year without bringing in new money. So they're going to have to keep doing fundraising, just like WHFR has to do once a year. We get a very small stipend from the from Henry Ford College. It's the same amount of money that comes from student fees that helps to support the college newspaper and the theater program for the public and the music programs for the public, too, as well as the art gallery on campus, which is open to the public. So each of our groups gets about $20,000 each year, but our budget is closer to $60,000. We can't operate less than that, even with an all-volunteer staff. And the college, thank you very much, are actually paying my part-time salary and the two other management people here helping to guide and supervise the volunteer staff from their administrative and teaching budgets. So that's the money we're raising doesn't go to myself and the other two. So thank you very much, Henry Ford College, for that. And they pay the electric bills and replace some light bulbs for us and heating, cooling, all of that. So thank you very much, Henry Ford College. But we have to raise about $40,000 every year. We just had a holistic fair, which was attended by a lot of people. We made more money than we've ever done in the past 7 years of it. And so thank you very much for those that supported that. We've got other events coming up. If you stay listening to the station over the next week or so, you'll find out about all the big events coming up in the next several weeks. Right now, though, I will get back to the news. That endowment, of course, I'm sure you can make contributions at any time. It should say there, yes, okay, right. Museum, of course, is at 915 Brady Street. If you'd like to make a donation to the endowment online, you can visit the DHM.com, DearbornHistoricalMuseum.com. So that's the, though. You have to put the word T-H-E in there. That's the website address, T-H-E-D-H-M.com. All donations are tax deductible. And if you want information, you can call 313-565-3000. The Dearborn Historical Museum is also on Facebook and Twitter. So you can post to them, you can tweet them, a service that the city really, really should have. If we forget the past, how does that go? We're doomed to repeat our mistakes in the future. Yeah, and that's not fun. That's embarrassing, in fact. All right. Also, on the front page of Dearborn Press and Guide from last Sunday, Dearborn Heights is going to celebrate the 10th anniversary of the reconstruction of the Carolyn Kennedy and John F. Kennedy Jr. libraries. The reconstruction and expansion of the two libraries in the same city may seem antithetical to the many news stories heralding the demise of this traditional institution and the rise of the digital age. Dearborn closing one library, maybe more, cutting back on budgets. Oh, people don't use the library anymore. Well, that's not the story that we hear from Michael McCaffrey, who is director of the Dearborn Heights library system and someone who has spent most of his career in research and information. He said libraries fulfill two critical roles in a thriving community. One, they provide access to the most valuable commodity on earth, information, and two, they foster a sense of tradition, which is what I was also saying, but not in those words, about the Dearborn Historical Museum. Tradition, very, very important to continue traditions of value and merit, of course. So McCaffrey goes on talking enthusiastically about that. Congratulations, of course, to the people of Dearborn Heights who made that possible through a special vote to support the libraries. You know, Dearborn has voted to have minimal staffing for the police and fire department one way or the other. It's either in our city charter or other votes came up, and that's a vote of support saying that our budget of the city must be used to support a minimum number of police and fire under which the city cannot go. And it's quite a large story about the libraries in Dearborn Heights. It's continued on page 7A. This is last Sunday's press and guide. And it's really a great support for all the libraries in the future. A lot of libraries are succeeding around the country, fantastically successful. They need some money to get set up to provide what people need these days. Well, we'll conclude by just saying, in honor of this, on April 18th, at the Carolyn Kennedy Library from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m., and JFK Library from 1 to 4 p.m., April 25th. That's John F. Kennedy Jr. Library, I believe. These open houses are a chance to thank city residents for their support and to engage residents who rarely or never visit the libraries. They're going to have food trucks, live music, and, in fact, a great friend at WHFR is going to be doing a big event for us on the evening of April 18th. R.J. Spangler is going to be performing with just one other fellow doing some bebop blues at the John F. Kennedy Library, I believe it's that one. But so the open houses are 11 to 4 at the Carolyn Kennedy Library in Dearborn Heights on April 18th, Saturday, April 18th, and from just 1 to 4 at JFK. I'm fairly sure that that R.J. Spangler is going to be at the Carolyn Kennedy, because I know it's April 18th. But anyway, the JFK Library open house is going to be from 1 to 4, and that's April 25th, the following Saturday. So go and visit. Go and visit your local libraries, Dearborn, Dearborn Heights, and make use of them. They have a lot of sources of information, and it's all free to city residents. Imagine. Free. Free. Yes. Your tax dollars at work. And in Dearborn Heights, God bless them, they had a special vote. And the majority of people voting at that time said, we want to have everyone in the city pay extra money to make sure our libraries are on firm ground and continue in the future. So good for them. We might need something like that to support our institutions in Dearborn if city government doesn't feel they can manage somehow. Too bad. Okay, moving on. It's not quite halfway through our hour. New WHFR Journal, Jay Koronek, your host here. We're looking at the Dearborn Times Herald from this last Wednesday, April 1st. And, you know, this year I didn't hear or see anywhere an April Fool's joke. And that's good, because I always hated to be fooled. Practical joke. I hated practical jokes all the time, but April 1st, you should be expecting them. I didn't get one. I didn't see one anywhere. So good. Because I think that can mislead and mess up people and make them do something wrong or even hurt or injure them, depending on the kind of cruel. Sometimes jokes are cruel, you know. And so maybe we're out of the fooling concept. Tradition in Europe, though, there actually was a sort of a court jester or fool's day, and that had a very good social purpose, and it's kind of unbelievable, but once a year for one day, this is in Renaissance, in the Middle Ages in Europe, you know, Western Europe, that the king of the area would allow his peasants, his commoners, that he had total control over, but he would allow them to make fun of him and anything else for that matter. They could go crazy for a day and say or do whatever they wanted to do without hurting the king, of course, or his family. And you've probably also heard or seen or that many courts, they also had court jesters. And they were for entertainment. They sometimes played music, juggled and things like that. But also they were considered a counselor for the king because they were expected to speak honestly to the king. Excuse me, Emperor, you don't have any clothes on? Oh, well, thank you for telling me. So that was the jester's place to speak honesty as well as ridicule and satire and so on to the king. And the king would not cut his head off for saying that. The whole idea was he needed somebody that would be that open and that direct and pointing out errors or inconsistencies or stupidity. I think we all need that. It's hard to face it, but we just don't like to see people you know, attacking us endlessly and mercilessly on social media. That's what we can't stand for, something that wasn't all that significant. I've not been victim of that myself, but many people have, and it hasn't been good result for these people. Also in the Times Herald of this week, Dearborn budget discussions are scheduled. I mentioned this story last week, but let's see what's coming up at least next in that schedule in case you really want to be part of Dearborn City government in terms of what they spend money for and how they raise money. Then you have to go to cityofdearborn.org and find out what the schedule is. Or, as he turns the pages here on the air, okay, we've had a few budget workshops, and they're in the City Council meeting room in the new City Hall. And let's see, the April 14th is the next one, then April 20th, 23rd, and 27th, and also finally May 4th. And the schedules might change. You need to go to cityofdearborn.org in the transparency section. That's where they have information about their future meetings. Might be interesting to hear it directly from the horse's mouths. Also, they mention, and this is in City of Dearborn press releases, but public service days begin this coming Monday, April 6th. That's the city's annual program here in Dearborn to keep streets clean and maintain high neighborhood standards. Parking rules will be enforced, which means anti-parking rules. You can't park on the streets the week or during that week. Anyway, here's how it is. Residents are required to keep parked vehicles off neighborhood streets from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. on their trash days. So for some people, it's Monday. For other people, it's Tuesday. But starting with Monday, trash pickup, whatever the trash pickup day is for you, you need to have your cars off the street. Tickets will be issued to cars parked on the street on a neighborhood trash day, public service day. Tickets will also be used to vehicles parked across sidewalks, on the easement, or on lawns. The easement is a part between the street and the sidewalk. If you have a sidewalk in front of your house, public sidewalk. I don't. I live in a neighborhood in Dearborn. We don't have any sidewalks. How is that possible, you ask? I don't know. That was part of the plan. Again, if you want more information about public service day rules, you can go to the cityofdearborn.org. And they do have some suggestions about parking exemptions or complications. And if you say, well, I just really don't have any place to park my car. It's just the way my house was built, the land was designed, or whatever. contact the city of Dearborn about that. And first, go to their website and see if you can find out some ways around the problem. Okay? Wonderful. Let's listen to a couple comments now, as we do usually about halfway through the hour. One from Jim Hightower, our nationally known, well, I think he's internationally known, either even populist, who's based in Austin, Texas. And he's talking about the 2016 presidential candidates. After his two-minute commentary, we'll also hear from Jack Lessenberry about the bottom line on that May 5th proposal election. Here they come.
At last, America's political leaders indicate that they now feel the pain of the poor and of the millions of working families slipping out of the middle class. Congress had previously paid no attention to the ever-widening chasm between the rich and the rest of us, but it has recently emerged as a central issue for such Republican presidential contenders as Jeb Bush, Ted Cruz, Rand Paul, and Marco Rubio. They're publicly lamenting the wealth gap and, by golly, proposing solutions. Alas, though, the solution proposed by each of them is not to provide help for those who've been knocked down, but to offer aid to the same corporate elites who've been knocking down the middle class and holding down the poor. Specifically, their solution is to cut taxes on corporations and the rich, do away with environmental and labor protections, and cut or privatize government programs, from Head Start to Social Security, that ordinary people count on. For example, Senator Rubio proposes to kill the food stamp program, even though the need for it is greater than ever, and redirect that money into what he calls a subsidy for low-wage workers. Does he think we have sucker wrappers around our heads? That's not a subsidy for workers, but for low-wage employers. Why should taxpayers subsidize the poverty pay of profitable giants like McDonald's, rather than making them pay living wages and cover their own labor costs? This is Jim Hightower saying, I guess we should count it as progress that candidates are at least having to admit that inequality is a problem. But come on, offering the same old failed anti-government snake oil is an insult to the American people. Jeb Bush shows how vacuous their flim-flammery is by saying that, to address the ever-widening wealth and income gap, he'll, quote, celebrate success and cherish free enterprise. Gosh, what a comfort that'll be to America's hard-hit majority, huh?
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
A number of people have been outraged that I haven't denounced a constitutional amendment that would raise the sales tax, largely to fix the roads. Well, in a less than perfect world, this is indeed not how legislation should be made. But in a perfect world, you and I would both exercise more and maybe have studied just a little harder in algebra class. Yes, the legislature should have solved this problem, primarily by raising the gas tax, something we would barely notice, especially with the low fuel prices today. Yes, it was wrong to pass the buck to the voters, with a regressive sales tax as the only possible option. But the bottom line is this. If the voters pass Proposal 1 May 5th, there will be significantly more money to fix state and local roads. Probably not enough, but they'll get better. There will also be a little more money for local governments and the schools, and even some to invest in mass transit. Plus, the working poor would get a much-needed break. The EITC, the Earned Income Tax Credit stripped from them earlier in the Snyder administration, would be fully restored. For many, this will make a significant difference. If the voters turn down Proposal 1, none of these good things will happen, at least not for years, and the roads will get worse and worse. Politics really is the art of the possible, and I don't think there's any other rational choice. Polls show, however, that voters are ready to turn this down. They don't understand the ballot proposal and don't trust it. This seems especially true of Democrats. To be sure, many are divided and resentful that they're being asked to carry the Republicans' water on this. One senior party official told me, "No one is giving voice to the primary Democratic objection to this measure. Individuals are increasingly paying more for the cost of government, while corporations are not. This person thinks the business community should have had to give back some of their massive tax breaks to help the roads." Most Tea Party types are also against Proposal 1 because they believe the utterly false claim that you can find money to fix the roads without boosting taxes. However, cooler heads on both sides know better. Proposal 1 has been endorsed by Carl Levin and John Dingell, by the AFL-CIO, the Michigan Environmental Council, and even the Sierra Club. Endorsements don't mean as much to me as explanations, and I turn to an authority I trust, Michigan State University economist Charles Ballard. "I'm voting for Proposal 1," he said. Yes, he agreed the sales tax hurts the poor more, but he added, "A lot of low-income Michigan families will see a net increase in their incomes if it passes." And, he added, "the poor are paying an even more regressive tax now, what Ballard calls the pothole tax, my name for the car repairs that wouldn't have been necessary if we had decent roads." The bottom line is that we can pass this, or things will continue to get worse for those who can afford at least, with no relief in sight. However you vote, you should do so without illusions.
Thank you to Jim Hightower and Jack Lessenberry and Michigan Public Radio for Jack Lessenberry. That's nice that we can add their voices to that, to the discussion we're going on today. About that election, which is happening May 5th, you will have through this Monday, April 6th, to register to vote for that. So if you've never voted before in Michigan and you're of legal age and you've got a residency somewhere, okay, and you can prove it, go to your friendly city clerk's office and sign up. But Monday, end of the day Monday, is the, and that's probably 4 o'clock, 4:30, whatever, is the last day that you can register to vote for the May 5th election. Of course, once you're registered and you don't change your place of residency, you can go and vote at any election upcoming. Okay? Don't have to worry about not being ready to vote. I mean, once you're in the file, you're in the file. And I can think of no valid reason why you wouldn't want to register to vote. Even if you think you don't want to encourage these terrible people who run our government and are keeping it at gridlock, maybe you'll find a great candidate at the last second, at the last minute, that the day the polls are open. Or in this case, a great reason to vote yes or no on Proposal 1 on May 5th. Even though you might think, I'm not going to vote on that either way. I don't know. I don't care. Well, you might all of a sudden discover you do care. And if you're not registered by a month in advance, you can't vote. So tell your friends, tell your neighbors, if they're not registered to vote, get registered. Be ready to vote in case the spirit moves you, as I hope it does. Maybe it'll encourage you to even read a little, talk to people, go to some of these events. And there's one coming up at U of M Dearborn this coming week, too. Let me talk about these events. Okay. Here at Henry Ford College, it's not related to that, but anyway, going chronologically here, what we call GlobeFest is going on in our student center, which is the same building where WHFR has its studios, here at Henry Ford College main campus, Evergreen Road just south of Ford Road. And our GlobeFest is only going to take 2 hours from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Next Wednesday in this building. It's sponsored by our Council of World Cultures. It's coordinated by several HFC clubs, including the African American Association, Amnesty International Club, Baking Club, Community Service Club, International Student Organization, Lebanese American Heritage Club. We got a lot of clubs here, folks. The Phi Theta Kappa, which is a fraternity, I guess, and the Student Environmental Association is part of it, too. GlobeFest is a cultural celebration featuring delicious ethnic cuisine, energizing entertainment, and enlightening information about select countries represented at this event, which this time it's going to be Egypt, Ireland, Lebanon, Mexico, Pakistan, Thailand, and Yemen. And by the way, HFC will also celebrate Earth Day April 22nd with participants learning about various ways to recycle. But more details about that as we get close to April 22nd. GlobeFest is free and open to the public. Just get to the main campus, come to the Student Center between 11 and 1 next Wednesday. Food will be available for purchase. It's $2 per food station ticket, or $5, big discount, for 3 food station tickets. And you give 1 ticket per food station. So you can sample a number of of goodies that way. And these clubs make a little money, I think, probably too, to do other good things for themselves and for the community. Because clubs are organized for the good of the club so that they can further their own interests, like, as I just said, baking or the environment or whatever, that they actually give back once they're able to raise their money first. So further information, call the Office of Student Activities at Henry Ford College about GlobeFest. But very simply, just get down here next Wednesday, April 8th, and the food costs a few bucks, but there will be live entertainment too, so it might be fun for a couple hours around lunchtime. Okay. Now, about the Michigan roads and the raising of the sales tax, and it's not just for the roads, you know, it's for other things. The second of programs that have been sponsored by the League of Women Voters, Dearborn Heights, or at least advertised. This one was actually set up at University of Michigan Dearborn, just south of Henry Ford College here. It's going to be in room 1500 at their Social Science Building, 1500 in their Social Sciences Building, this Thursday, April 9th. Now, there's a networking opportunity, among citizen groups? Whoever, between 5 and 6 p.m. But the program, actually, to talk about the Proposal 1 special election on May 5th is from 6 to 7:30 p.m. Light refreshments will be available. Although, it's not saying if there's a cost or not. But parking, however, is free in the parking garage or surface lot across from the Social Sciences Building. So once you find the Social Sciences Building, wherever there's a parking lot that's a parking garage or lot across from the SSB, it's free. Now, they do encourage you to give an RSVP if you're thinking of coming. Bill Hatley, H-A-T-L-E-Y, that's Hatley at umich.edu. I'll give you his number. If you're listening to the podcast, you can just rewind the file, sort of, and listen again, 313-388-6210. That's probably just so they have enough chairs to sit in and or food, light refreshments for everyone. So that's a special discussion talking about Proposal 1 special election this Thursday, April 9th at University of Michigan Dearborn Social Sciences Building, room 1500. Okay. Turning back to other news here in WHFR.FM, the station making waves, doing things a little different than other stations. This program is the new WHFR Journal, local news and alternative views. And remember, all opinions expressed on this show today by yours truly, or read or presented, I guess those podcasts counted too as opinions, are not necessarily opinions of Henry Ford College faculty, staff, administrators, or students. But thank you very much, HFC, for letting us do this. Dearborn Press and Guide from this last Wednesday, April 1st. The former Howe School of the Dearborn Public Schools is off the market. They've been trying to sell it, and they were getting a bunch of low bids. They thought it was worth a couple million dollars or more, and nobody gave them the right amount of money. So that bid, the bidding process is closed down right now. One reason they thought it might be prime real estate was because several areas next to it had been bought by, Oakwood Hospital? Oakwood Medical Center more than a year ago bought St. Martha's Church and Parish Hall, and that's adjacent to House School and across from the hospital. Yeah, Oakwood paid $2.3 million for the church, which actually sits on a smaller site. And the district thinks now that its enrollment has been growing every year, just like population in Dearborn has been growing every year, that maybe it's going to need another building, or at least another space to put a new building on. So maybe they're just going to keep it for a while. I thought that was interesting news. I don't know. Of course, we're looking for a new superintendent, as I mentioned, and you probably heard that our present superintendent, Brian Winston, has accepted the appointment to become the state superintendent of schools, working with the Board of Education of the state of Michigan, elected by the public. So he's going to see what he can do for the state of Michigan starting July 1st. So we need to look for a new permanent superintendent here in Dearborn who might have some new ideas or new directions for us. Always interesting to consider, I believe. Craig Varan does have an editorial in last Wednesday's, and he corrects something. We had a great discussion once every about 3 months on our Tuesday forum, a locally hosted show with a variety of different topics each week on WHFR. All of them are podcasts, so if you don't have one to 2 o'clock on Tuesday available, you can listen from our website anywhere in the world, WHFR.fm, click on Talk Shows, click on Tuesday Forum, and then select the date. So this last Tuesday, it was the 31st, so 3:31 was Dearborn Heights News and Views, and we had City Councilman Ned Napigian in the studio here, and a city assessor, whose first name was Justin. I don't want to mispronounce his last name, so I won't pronounce it now. But so we talked most of the hour about how are property values set, and what is it that raises the value of your land or decreases it. And we also got into the fact that we mentioned Proposition A, which was passed by voters back in the 70s. I confused in my mind the Henley Amendment and the Proposal A from the past, because they did slightly different things. In case you're listening to that, and it's an interesting podcast, and it really does pick up after the first half hour, so keep listening. Find out a lot of things, at least about how they do property values and how you can get the property values maybe readjusted if you think they're too high and you're paying too much taxes for no good reason. In any event, here's, coincidentally, Craig Ferenz. Spin on things, and he gets it right because he writes this. He doesn't talk off the top of his head. That's one advantage of people that write. They usually think it through before they put pen to ink. Ink to pen? Pen to paper. I get it. Okay. He says, in Michigan, we have two classic examples of unintended consequences that we've been dealing with for decades, and no one has even attempted to deal with the problems inadvertently created by those decisions. The first is the Henley Amendment. The second is Proposal A. Both laws were designed to prevent the inefficient and often punishing aspects of levying property taxes, but both have created straitjackets in which we're entangled today. And this was somewhat mentioned in the Dearborn Heights News and Views show from this last Tuesday, even though I think I sort of rolled the Henley Amendment into our discussion of Proposal A. As Craig Ferran goes on, he says, Michigan's constitutional amendment was named for Richard Henley, who once served as Governor George Romney's campaign manager. Henley championed the amendment in the 70s, and in 1982 lost to Jim Blanchard in the race for Michigan governor. It was in November of 1978 that Michigan voters approved the amendment, which, among other things, limits the collection of property tax increases to 5%, or the rate of inflation, whichever is less. Anything more than that results in a rollback of the millage rate. Proposal A, which was passed by voters in March 1994, changed the fundamental methods by which public education is funded. First, it established a per-pupil foundation grant with a floor for spending, and then tied annual increases to legislative funding decisions based on annual increases in overall state revenue. Proposal A also shifted the bulk of financial education from property tax to the sales tax, which was increased by 50%, from 4% to 6%. That means that state taxes, not local property taxes, would fund the bulk of local school district operating costs. Today, Craig Ferran goes on to say, we pay a 6 mil local school property tax that is sent to Lansing, mixed with revenues from across the state and then reallocated based on that per pupil formula. Non-residential property owners pay 18 mils, which also is sent to Lansing. One of the great puzzlers, he says in parentheses here, is why Michigan voters have to approve the renewal of the non-residential property tax, but not their own homeowner tax. So today we live under the control of two often at odds funding mechanisms, neither of which works very well in this century. Now, certainly Henley saved many a homeowner from exorbitant and outlandish property tax increases that were due exclusively to inflationary property tax increases in the 70s and 80s. but we no longer live in an inflationary society. The Federal Reserve's sole role in life is to rein in inflation, and it has done so for decades, with no evidence of abandoning this goal. Yes, there were property tax increases associated with the housing boom of the 1990s and early 2000s, but that was due to the real growth in values, not artificial inflationary growth. And yes, our cities benefited from that growth, as did our school districts, which meant we got improved services, which also meant that everything seemed to be running smoothly. The two laws seemed to be functioning perfectly. Until the housing crash of 2008. First, school district and municipal revenues tied to property values tanked. That means they went down. To nothing, empty tank, to the point that both governmental entities entered death spirals that put some into receivership, emergency management, dissolution, or bankruptcy. But the pain didn't end there, he goes on to say, which is where both laws became albatrosses around the necks of Michigan, the neck of Michigan, to use a metaphor from a famous poem. You see, we've had a rebound of sorts in Michigan, he says. Michigan property values. If you read the front page story in Sunday News Herald by staff writer Ann Runkle, you'd see that downriver property values increased in every community except Lincoln Park, Rouge River, and Gros Isle. Great news, right? Sure, if you're someone trying to sell your house and wanting top dollar, it's great to see selling prices going back up. But if you're a city or school district hoping to reap the rewards of a rebounding housing market, well, dream on. Between Headley's inflation limits and Proposal A's structural shortcomings, these increased property values are not being translated into a recouping of lost revenues that cities and schools felt over the last decade. In fact, according to some downriver leaders, it will take years to recoup all of the losses from the housing market collapse. And to move away from Craig's article, which goes on for a while, you need to read it yourself. That's one reason to subscribe to Press and Guide. Read Craig Ferran's articles, his editorials, all the way through. Okay? Because he's got a lot of great, intelligent things to say, good research there. So by all means, you should do that. By the way, I said that, you know, Mayor O'Reilly pointed to this in his State of the City address last month, and he seemed to indicate that in a couple of years we're going to be in great financial difficulty because even though property values are going up, the city and the schools, too, separate entities, but they both have the same problem. We're not getting the money we should be getting from increased property values, and so we're hurting. And so the schools and the city have to find another way to support themselves, and Mayor O'Reilly hasn't said what that might be. I think it's still about 2 years away before we have to make that decision for the city. We will have Mayor O'Reilly on the show the whole hour or as soon as he can get here on April 17th. So 2 weeks from today, April 17th, Mayor O'Reilly here on the new WHFR Journal answering all of our questions. And boy, does he have answers. Seriously. He can give detailed rationale for almost anything that's going on. He's extremely knowledgeable. You may disagree with his conclusions or his approaches to solving certain problems, but he is very well versed in all aspects of city government after his whole history, not just his father being mayor, but his years of public service and city council, and he knows the city of Dearborn upside down and backwards, and very competent. And of course, he was reelected last time around. I think it was at least 70% of the vote, but he didn't really have a significant challenger, just because the person didn't have any money to campaign, and so he wasn't a so-called real candidate. He was a real candidate, and as I said, 20-some percent, almost 30% of voters did vote for him, even though most of them probably didn't know who he was. So, but 70% is a good approval rating in that sense. So going back to the editorial page or op-ed page from The Press and Guide, with only 3 minutes left, Proposal 1 from Terry Dangerfield. Is that his real name? Yes, it is, unless it's an April Fool joke. He's the superintendent of Lincoln Park Public Schools. And he says that Proposal 1, if you vote for it and it passes, would protect school aid funds' future. So there's several reasons behind that, and I can't go into the details here, but it's true that the sales tax increase from 6% to 7%, if approved, would not just go to fix the roads. That's the primary thing it would start to do. It's probably not enough money to fix the roads, to be honest, but it would start to do that, although not until a year or two, until the money started rolling in. You've got to start paying the extra money before they have the money to spend it. But nonetheless, but there are several other things that the money is going to, and one is to our schools. And yeah, I think you'll find most superintendents, just like you'll find most mayors, now jumping on the bandwagon trying to say, please vote yes, because more money will come to us. And one reason they need it is because of Headley Amendment and Proposal A working against us, not for the original purpose of those two proposals. They're actually working against us in a time when property values are going up, and property values are the number one way we get money for city and for schools, and they're not responding to the property values because they're artificially being held back by a combination of the Headley Amendment and Proposition A. So we got that one clear, right? That's sort of like a correction from last week, folks, or from Tuesday, if you happen to catch Dearborn Heights News and Views on our forum show. Where else are you going to get programs like this? Where else? Now, I do want to mention our big gala. It is a fundraising event. We've never had a fundraising event that costs so much for admission, only $50 a person, though, and that includes easily $30 per person for entertainment and open bar and a huge buffet dinner, several entrees. You can go back a second time or a third, and also a huge dessert bar filled in there. And, you know, it's not tuxedo, but just a little bit dressy. $50 a person, all ages can attend. You have to show ID if you want alcoholic beverages at the event. We're going to be at Park Place Banquet Center, which is in West Dearborn, just off Outer Drive, south of Michigan Avenue. Wonderful facility. Thank you, Gary Coleman, for making it available to us for a small amount of money. And it's going to be a great evening. R.J. Spangler and his Kansas City Six, a new local group of that he has put together that sounds fantastic, doing tribute to the sound of jazz and blues from the 1930s and 40s from the Kansas City area. And also we're going to have music after dinner from Brazil and Beyond, a Brazilian sound pop guitar duo. And that's all going to be great fun. We hope we can see you there. We're celebrating our 30 years, and you, our loyal listeners, we'd like you to have you there and helping out on this. Somebody said, whoa, 50 a person. I can't afford that. Wait a minute. Did you go out to movies last week with your best friend or buddy? Okay, how much was your dinner for the two of you? Okay, I bet it was $60, including a tip. How much were those movie passes? $12 more for each of you? Okay. So that's $85 right there. And you're not getting live entertainment like R.J. Spangler and the Kansas City Six for 2 hours and Brazil and Beyond for 45 minutes, as well as this huge, sumptuous banquet and all beverages. We don't want you to drink alcoholic beverages and go crazy, of course, but, you know, you want a soda pop, you want water, you know,